Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
Big Sky Conference presidents met yesterday, took the recommendations of their athletic directors, and came away with a decision on the Big Sky Conference football season. Tom Wistersill is the commissioner of the Big Sky Conference. He's joining us now. Tom, what did the presidents decide? How did that come out?
Decided that we would not play football this fall, that we would move football to the spring for our conference, and look forward to hopefully creating an FCS championship for the spring.
With the Big Sky Conference in the spring season, are we talking about 8 games conference only at that point?
Yeah, that's exactly what our plan is right now. Now, we still need to work with the MCA to create a championship. Right now, that hasn't been done. But our plan is, once we're able to create that championship and see what the bracket looks like, then we would build an 8-game conference-only schedule starting right now, targeting sometime in probably late March, when we could begin.
Our guest, Tom Wistersill, who is the commissioner of the Big Sky Conference. What does this mean for other sports within the Big Sky?
Yeah, so we made a decision a couple weeks ago for the other fall sports, in this case, soccer, volleyball, cross country, that we would not have a non-conference schedule, and we would focus in on a conference schedule starting September 18th. Now that allows our schools to focus in on those groups that are smaller than football and see, can we actually follow the testing procedures? Can we actually safely sports? And we're not fully convinced that we can yet, but that's why we want to get a little more time involved to see if we can do that as a conference. And then secondly, the NCAA still has the fall championships in place for those sports, so we'll also monitor that as well.
The recommendation from the athletic directors, did it fit what the presidents did? I'm not sure how that process works. Can you let us in a little bit?
Yeah, typically, you know, we have our administrators, both the faculty reps, the athletic directors, senior women's administrators, all weigh in on these types of decisions, and we gather that information from the medical committee, and then the athletic directors made a recommendation to the presidents that the presidents followed, and a lot of discussion about the various things that go into this, because being spread out over 8 states with our 13 football-playing schools makes it difficult to get everybody on the same page, but credit to our presidents who came together and said, let's focus in on the safety and health of our student-athletes, and made the decision to move to the spring.
Tom Wistersill is with us. He is the commissioner of the Big Sky Conference. Major college athletics, I mean, and I say major, I just mean the Power 5 conferences, essentially, are still planning to move forward. Is there any chance with you in the spring, if they end up in the spring, that some of those non-conference games that we all love to see might be played?
You know, you never say never. We can't predict the future right now, what's going on. That's why we're trying to plan out what ours looks like. So I would never say never to that. You know, what I do know is that obviously a lot has to change as far as testing, as far as our control of the virus, potentially a vaccine. A lot has to change between now and then for us to even have football in the spring. But we're planning on that being the case. We got confidence in our medical communities across this country that can get this done. So we'll never say never to anything, but we're going to plan on what we can control, and we'll worry about the other stuff later.
The reaction from athletes, have you had a chance to talk to individual coaches, or are those discussions that are happening today on campuses across the Big Sky?
Yeah, that's what's going on right now. I've talked to a couple of our coaches today, and they've just been very positive, happy to have a decision, feel like we did the right thing for our student athletes. We needed to give them some specifics as to what this looked like, their lives looked like over the next few months. And now we can focus in on opening our campuses and bringing people together on campus and see how we can safely do that.
Tom, you know, from the beginning of this, I felt like, look, we're all in new ground and we're all kind of in it together. And when the Pac-12 in particular went to a conference-only schedule, I said, gosh, this really hurts the Big Sky. You had seven games that were affected by cancellations, six programs. Everyone else thought lawsuits, but I kind of looked at it as, look, you want to have relationships with the Pac-12 schools. You want those to be ongoing good relationships. Does you guys canceling and going to the spring, does that help sort of ease the idea that, hey, there would have been a bunch of litigation here, or is some of that to be determined?
Yeah, no, I think that what happens is exactly what you said is, you know, we have good relationships with the Pac-12, whether it be at the conference level or at the individual school level. Our schools, you know, overlap so many of them that we work together so carefully on all different sports. So, you know, I look at it and say that each conference had to make difficult decisions for the best of their conference. And then we'll address, you know, 21 and the years on, you know, going forward. But I don't think there's any relationships damage there. And, you know, if anything, this type of thing, when you're dealing with difficult situations, at times can strengthen those relationships. So we'll approach it in the most positive way we can and move on from there.
The money's driving the bus, obviously, with a lot of decisions right now. Everybody would like to protect television revenue. Is it an easier discussion for your presidents and ADs because you're not sitting on $30 million in media rights distributions, or was it still a tough decision to say, hey, let's go to the spring?
So, you know, it's always a tough decision when you're looking at changing the lives of, you know, everybody involved. You never take those decisions lightly. But, you know, once we started to consider our ability to follow the testing guidelines, to get all of those tests back in time, to safely really feel like we could do it, the decision really became pretty easily arrived at and pretty obvious to our presidents. And like I said, now they can focus in on opening campuses, and then we can start to focus in on what it looks like in the spring. So, you know, money was not a factor. It is, you know, it's a health and safety issue for us. And we're excited that we made it. We can give some direction to our people now, feel like we did the right thing, and move on.
Was there a reason, and correct me if you've touched on this in your news conference earlier today, but was there a reason that you didn't include all fall sports in this decision? Is there something that the public needs to know about that?
No, like I said, I think it's more about we made the decision on the other fall sports a couple weeks ago to delay the decision to start until September 18th. So we buy ourselves a couple more weeks to see what we can do as far as testing goes with some of those smaller groups. Can we safely have a cross-country meet? Can we have a volleyball game? Those types of things. So we buy ourselves a little time there. Plus the NCAA championship is still in play for those fall sports. So the decision to delay is simply that. It doesn't mean we're automatically playing. It doesn't mean we're canceling it. It just means we're going to make that decision at a later date.
I think you got it right. I mean, I think you have to put safety first, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what this is all about. I mean, this is such a, you know, uncharted territory for everyone. But, you know, the bottom line is for us is we have to figure out a way to open our campuses safely, get students there, get the professors there. Let's see how that works. And then we'll worry about college athletics here as we roll along.
What happens to eligibility for Big Sky athletes? Will the NCAA, as I understand it, says that athletes who opt out may receive another year of eligibility. Is that a conference decision, individual university? How does that work?
We're working directly with the NCAA on that. There are waivers that are being applied for. Eligibility is still a little bit of a gray area. We have to work through as an entire association in Division I. So lots to be worked out there. Nothing is set in stone yet. But, you know, I do know that, you know, as a student-athlete-friendly organization, we're going to find ways to help our student athletes through these difficult decisions. Nobody wants to do anything that penalizes anyone for making tough choices. So it's just going to take a little bit of time. There's a lot of moving parts that deal with eligibility, fall sports moving to spring, some fall sports staying. You know, you got multiple choices that all the conferences are making, but we'll all be working closely with the NCAA on those topics.
Help me out with this, and this is just like a question of humanity, but I find a lot of people criticizing athletes for wanting to sit out, and I just don't get that. If someone doesn't feel comfortable, I don't want them out there on the field.
Yeah, to me, that's an incredibly selfish opinion for someone to have. Each person has to make their own decision about their own health and safety, just like they would in the normal course of life. And I'm not going to question anyone's decision to do that. This is uncharted territory, as I said. Nobody knows the long-term effects of this virus on them. And our medical community is working so hard to try to solve this and trying to figure out ways to get our society back to our normal run, of course. And no, I have no problem with people making the decision they feel is best for them. And that's what we should be about, supporting each other during this difficult time.
All right, Tom, I really appreciate your time. I know you got a busy day. Thanks for popping on with us and speaking to your fan bases out there. I appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to be on with you, John. A couple of bald guys talking. And let's stay in touch.
We will do. All right, Tom Wistersill, Big Sky Conference Commissioner. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, John.
All right, good stuff there from the guy in charge of the Big Sky Conference. They've made a decision. The Ivy League's made a decision. I think ultimately, if you are a college football fan, all eyes on the Power Fives. Will dominoes continue to fall? Leave it right here. I want your discussion. I want your input on that. 503-417-7575. Weigh in. Couple of big stories in the news today. Breaking story, ex-Angels employee charged in the overdose death of former Angels pitcher Tyler Skaggs. You may remember that Skaggs was found dead in his hotel room in Dallas last July before the start of what was supposed to be a four-game series against the Texas Rangers, July of 2019. Man, we're already in August. Man. Former Angels employee, former communications director named Eric Kay. He was arrested in Texas. He made his first appearance today in federal court. He is being charged with conspiracy to distribute fentanyl in connection with that overdose death. Apparently, Skaggs died after choking on his own vomit. He had a toxic mix of alcohol and painkillers, fentanyl and oxycodone in his system, according to the coroner's report. Prosecutors are accusing Kay of providing the fentanyl to Skaggs and some others. It's really an interesting case to me. And you know, I've got friends who are in the legal profession and friends, in fact, one friend who's a prosecutor. And I would be curious to know, like, I understand, like, the legalities of somebody providing an illegal drug to somebody else who has an accident with it. You are culpable. You're breaking a law there. I just sometimes tend to begin and end a tragedy like this by looking at the individual themselves, Tyler Skaggs. And I could be talked off this position. This is one of these things. I might be wrong about this. Maybe I'm a horrible human being for saying, isn't this all on Tyler Skaggs? And I know that maybe you know an addict. I've known people who have suffered and battled addiction. And I've often thought to myself, like, you know, a lot of times we try to help addicts or we try to help people who are struggling with substances and we feel helpless. Other times we feel helpless because they find a way, right? Because the addiction, it becomes too powerful for them to overcome. I just wonder how much in your mind you put on Tyler Skaggs here, who is the individual who dies, and how much do you put on Eric Kay, who is being accused of helping provide that fentanyl to Tyler Skaggs. 503-417-7575 if you want to weigh in on that. Do either of you have a thought on that? Do you what degrees of blame do you put on the individual who was apparently struggling with addiction and apparently struggling with substance abuse, and it cost him his life, versus Eric Kay, who played a role in helping get those drugs to the guy?
So the thing about this situation that we don't know yet, or I don't know if we'll ever find out, is if Tyler was asking for the fentanyl. I feel like fentanyl is something that is oftentimes laced into drugs that the users are unaware of. And fentanyl is highly, highly, highly toxic, and people die from the smallest amount of fentanyl.
Right.
So I don't know if he was exactly seeking out that part of it, which probably, I'm sure, I mean, the mixture is toxic, but I don't know.
It's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right in that, you know, according to the coroner, there was this toxic sort of cocktail of alcohol and fentanyl and oxycodone that's in his system. Was Tyler Skaggs asking the communications director, hey, can you get me this stuff? And then the guy going out and getting it? Or did he say, hey, I want oxycodone, and what was provided to him had fentanyl in it and he didn't know it? But I think ultimately, like, the prosecutors have unwound this case and did it pretty quickly, probably using whatever text messages are on Tyler Skaggs' phone as he's communicating with the communications guy. Probably pretty easy for the prosecutors to say, hey, all right, this is who provided it to him. Here's how it went down. Here's the timing of it. I just ultimately, I keep coming back to Tyler Skaggs, and maybe I'm naive to this, but I'm not in the world of professional sports as an athlete. But the communications director at a team is usually an insider. It's somebody who's traveling with the team. It's somebody who is there to sort of facilitate the interview requests, somebody who's there to say, hey, so-and-so is available after the game or whatever, but becomes somebody who's around the players a lot. And I think about the various communications team members that are around the Blazers organization, around the Oregon Ducks, around Oregon State, and I immediately see them as sort of liaisons between the media and the players. But they are definitely on the team plane, definitely traveling with the team, definitely get to know the players on a personal level, and especially in baseball, where you have players that are around for 162 games. What I do know about Tyler Skaggs is that he had battled addiction, that this wasn't a one-off, that, you know, people had said, look, he had some addiction issues in his past. And I keep coming back to the idea that, you know, ultimately, if you're ingesting something, and I don't care if it's a performance enhancing drug or it's, you know, what you eat in your normal diet, you know, you ought to know what you're putting in your body. And maybe I'm naive to it because maybe stuff like this happens all the time in sports, and the communications director gave him something that he thought was an oxycodone and it ended up being laced with fentanyl. I don't know. Judah Newby, how much do you put on Tyler Skaggs? How much do you put on the former media relations employee, Eric Kay?
It's an unenviable position to be in, assigning blame in the midst of tragedy. But I understand the topic that we're getting at here. The more I read about Eric Kay, the more I don't have much sympathy for him. He's, you know, apparently shelling out these drugs to a lot of people, you know, not just Tyler Skaggs, doing so, you know, undercover, doing so, you know, underhandedly, just making sure that it was all, you know, no one was paying attention to it. But apparently there were some people on the Angels team that were aware that that he was, you know, supplying Skaggs with pills and a lot of others with pills too. That's just not, it's not a good thing to do. It's not a right thing to do. And it's certainly not something that the team's communications director should be mixed up in. So I certainly understand the responsibility, as tragic as it is, of someone that's battling addiction to be able to battle it. But I certainly assign most in this specific tragedy, I certainly assign a lot of it to Eric Kay. But you are right in that there is a conversation to be had around Skaggs' responsibility as well.
The ESPN's TJ Quinn reported last October that Kay was interviewed by federal investigators, admitted that he gave oxycodone to Skaggs, and the two of them abused it together for years. So that they were both using. He has been indicted for distributing the fentanyl to Skaggs. He's also been charged with possession and distribution. So I kind of wonder if this was something that federal investigators knew that was going on, and how many other people was he supplying drugs to? That's another thing there. But I also I come back to this. Like, I think if, you know, Eric Kay obviously holds some culpability here and should be punished for what he did, but he's facing 20 years in prison for providing the drugs to Tyler Skaggs. Clearly, both these guys had lost their way in some form or fashion. I feel awful for Skaggs' family, because not only do you have the loss of a husband and father in this case, but you've got sort of the idea that, as you know, this death is sort of unwound, and as the investigation now will become a criminal case happens, it's like this is going to get dragged out into the public. And really what we have here is a case of a player in Tyler Skaggs who had a long-standing battle with addiction, and it's a tragedy, and he's not alone. I mean, you look around the country and you see families that are affected by addiction. You see families that lose husbands and fathers and moms and wives and children who succumb to this. And maybe, you know, if there's any good that comes out of this, maybe the Eric Kay prosecution stops some enabler who's alongside some athlete and wants to be buddies with some athlete and provide drugs in exchange for being like, hey, I got in. This is my buddy now. Like, you're some kind of friend. I got news for Eric Kay. I don't think Tyler Skaggs was probably that interested in being friends with the communication guy. I think he was probably friends with him because he was getting drugs from him. And I think ultimately, like, maybe if there's some good that comes out of this, maybe some Yahoo's out there who thinks that they, you know, have garnered access to somebody else because they're providing an illegal, you know, outlet for them. Maybe that person wakes up and goes, you know, hey, this is something that I shouldn't be doing. Or frankly, maybe if you got somebody in your circle who's struggling with addiction, look at the circle itself. I mean, you know, it's one thing when you've got somebody who is suffering from mental illness or addiction that you look and say, this person is alone, this person is isolated. We've talked to Chris Herron on this show about addiction and how powerful that is, and what a struggle that was for him. I mean, such a powerful interview that we did with Chris Herron back in the day. And I just remember being profoundly moved by his candid nature, in which he talked about it became everything to him. It was bigger than his children. It was bigger than his wife. It was a more important and more powerful draw than anything else in his life. And he talked about that addiction. It was so powerful to hear him speak it, because I heard a guy battling himself and his own demons.
People's vision of a heroin addict is a guy sleeping, drooling, you know, dirty, you know, but, you know, that's his last day. You know, mine was with the Celtics, and when I started, and you know, I couldn't function without it. You know, I wasn't getting out of bed in the morning. I wasn't going to bed without it. And so, you know, sports and drugs, especially opiates, went hand in hand for me, because I wouldn't be able to do one without the other.
Chris Herron talking about that, and maybe I'll get Chris Herron back on the show. Punch It Audio is coming up. It is the best sound from all around. We've got it coming up next. I want you to leave it right.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.